Hello and welcome to the Reason Podcast Monday Editorial Brain Trust Division. I am your host, Matt Welch, joined by smarter people, including in Washington, D.C., Catherine Mengu Ward and Peter Suderman. Y'all are there?
Indeed, we are.
Great to be speaking with y'all.
Nick Gillespie, floating somewhere in semi-Perlando, semi-Perlando universe there, Nick.
Present.
Very good. Outstanding. Reminder at the top here, please do subscribe to us, rate and review us over at iTunes. I will remind people also that last week on this very podcast gathering here, Catherine Mengu Ward said, America, this is a quote, America is an idea about eagles. So who knew that Catherine Mengu Ward is the modern day Jimmy the Greek, predicting Super Bowl scores in sports.
Especially get her started on the race stuff, and she's totally like Jimmy the Greek.
I'm looking forward to hearing the rest of that poem at Trump's second inaugural.
I am the poet laureate now, so that should work out fine.
We are going to talk about the Eagles or the Super Bowl and other stuff, and also some very juicy right to try policy wonkery from the State of the Union address and going forward later in the podcast. But at the top, we need to address what the country is talking about, which is the memo. So House Intel Chair Devin Nunes on Friday uncorked a long-awaited four-page memo alleging that the FISA warrant taken out on former Trump foreign policy advisor Carter Page in 2016 relied a little bit too heavily, a lot too heavily, on a dossier that originated in the Hillary Clinton opposition research campaign without adequate disclosure thereof. This is a very canned version of what happened. Democrats on the committee have cried foul. They've released or tried to release their own memo. There's going to be a vote Monday at 5. We're talking here Monday morning, so it'll be voted on right after this thing is released. There are so many different aspects about all of this to talk about. So maybe Peter Suderman, starting with you, what is your takeaway from the memo itself, regardless of all the fire and furies happening around describing its contents and the production of it? Is the material contained within that memo alarming to you? Does it tell us something that is worrisome and that we needed to know?
Trying to sort through all of the narrative threads and backstory here, I mean, the whole thing is really, it's sort of like coming into the middle of season three of a really convoluted thriller that, like, no one was plotting very well to begin with. I mean, it's really sort of irritatingly complex and also kind of the threads on their own, a lot of them sort of don't seem to matter all that much, where they have only a kind of a secondary relevance. I think that the memo was way overhyped by Republicans. And I think that the biggest takeaway from the memo is that the investigation into Donald Trump's potential Russia connections, the whole sort of business that then sort of led eventually into the Mueller probe that we now have going on, that investigation did not start with Carter Page and the dossier put together by Michael Steele, who was being funded
by Christopher Steele. Remington.
Sorry, Michael Steele. Regret the error.
Steele was a very handsome
right,
man.
But it wasn't the investigation didn't start with the Steele dossier, which, of course, was being funded through a cutout by the DNC. And so the whole argument here has been that this whole Trump Russia investigation is just a kind of partisan setup paid for by bad information, by a crappy sort of set of unreliable information, an unreliable investigation put together in the Steele dossier. But in fact, it had been like this stuff had been going on beforehand. Carter Page, in fact, was a target of the FBI before any of this. And in fact, in 2013, wrote a letter basically saying he had contacts at the Kremlin and had been serving as an informal advisor there. And so the kind of the essential argument that this was supposed to make, that Republicans said it would make, I think has fallen flat. On the other hand, you know, I also think that that it's sort of useful as a way of thinking about how bad everyone in Congress is about talking about surveillance abuse. And the way, and like, this is, Republicans care about surveillance abuse now only, exclusively because they have, because it might affect their Republican president who the Republican base likes. And so it is entirely a sort of partisan, trumped up, to use a terrible phrase, kind of exercise in like caring only when your party is narrowly affected. And it's really just telling about how shallow and crappy both sides are, I think, when it comes to actually thinking about surveillance reform, what is acceptable in terms of what the government can and should be doing in terms of monitoring private citizens.
Can I throw in a couple other things? One is that, you know, to take it back even a step further, Peter, and I basically agree with you on your points, but it's one of the reasons why we're talking about Russia is because Russia is a way for Hillary Clinton and the Democrats to avoid responsibility for losing an election against the least competent, least experienced, least qualified presidential candidate pretty much in American history. And so we're primed to, it's got to have something to do with Russia, because right now, like, what are the charges that are going to come out of this? And we can assume that people like Paul Manafort and a couple of other people made improper connections with Russia, like Michael Flynn, you know. So are we going to find out that, you know, somehow
Paul Manafort, who was Trump's campaign chairman for a while, not like a volunteer advisor, somebody who was pretty relevant to our current president's campaign.
Like, nobody, I mean, like, seriously, from all of the data, unless something really comes out, one thing we know for sure is that just like America, Russia tries to influence foreign elections. You know, that they bought some stuff on Facebook, which by and large, whatever the large numbers are shown about how, it was in everybody's fake news feed and blah, 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 it had no effect on the outcome of this election. Does Donald Trump have scuzzy business dealings that might contravene American law? Yeah, probably. You know, Paul Manafort certainly did, or almost certainly did. So, I mean, it's important that we look at this not simply in terms of like what Republicans and Democrats want us to focus on is not even FISA, but on this memo and whether or not it's right or is it a death blow to the Republic if people actually learn how Congress deals with intelligence. You know, we had a debate, not much of a debate, over reauthorizing parts of FISA particularly the Section 702 stuff, which created a database under the rubric of trying to collect data on people who are not American citizens that just gave the government the ability to suck up all sorts of information that they, you know, that includes American communications that under the FISA rulings or under FISA statutes, the government shouldn't have access to. We're forgetting about that. I think the essential context of this story, Matt, is, you know, Devin Nunes is an idiot. Everybody knows it. Adam Schiff is a partisan. Everybody knows that. Congress is incompetent, and they are situational libertarians, as I think Jim Antle in the Washington Examiner said, and as Peter was saying, these parties only care about this kind of stuff and about having a rule of law that governs whether or not, you know, the federal government can snoop on you. They only care about that in the context of partisan stuff. We have a larger question of, you know, the Republican Party, and Donald Trump started this by saying he wasn't going to respect the outcome of the election unless he won. And then he managed to do something even better where he impugned the integrity of an election that he won. I mean, he's still trying to, you know, find 3 million votes. Voter fraud that, like, is the reason why he won the election, but Hillary won the popular vote. Hillary Clinton has been going after Trump. She refuses to take responsibility for running an unbelievably moronic campaign where she had it, you know, it's the second time in her career where all she had to do was do an easy layup, you know, to win the presidency, and she couldn't finish the job. You know, the wheels are coming off many aspects of American society because we've had 40 or 50 years of a richly deserved skepticism towards government and towards people in power. This is where it leads,
Catherine,
to a point where we're arguing about everything and everybody has incomplete facts.
Catherine, I think now in 2018, for myself at age 49, it's time for me to ask you, and I think you're the type of person who would know, what does the word gaslighting mean, and who's doing it most?
I feel like the word gaslighting is one of those words that's gotten completely out of control, like mansplain. So it used to mean this very specific, narrow thing.
Let me explain gaslighting to you.
Wow. There it is. There it is.
Who are you? Are you Charles Boyer?
Yes.
You know, get the fuck out, Peter. Let Catherine talk.
So that was called white knighting, and that's another one we should learn.
Wow. Very nice.
So, yes, gaslighting is where you convince someone that something they absolutely know is true is not true. And that's the simplest version of it. And this is a great example of how people have come into this giant, horrific, like spaghetti tangle of a debate. Already totally sure about what's true, and then invested massive resources in trying to gaslight each other to absolutely no avail. At the far end of this thing, every single person who thinks like, yeah, maybe somebody worked with the Ruskies to try and manipulate the election and maybe they were a little successful, still thinks that. Everyone who thinks surveillance is out of control still thinks that at the end of this debate. Nobody changed their minds. And, you know, in particular, when you see after the memo was released, you see these quotes from Ron Wyden and Rand Paul just saying like, oh, this proves what I always knew was true, which is that we shouldn't have voted to reauthorize FISA without more carefully examining Section 702. You know, people who are more national security focused all said, oh, this, you know, this shows which we knew to be true, which is that Russians are trying to meddle in U.S. elections, or Russians are definitely not meddling in U.S. elections, depending on your biases. I think this is just like a glorious, glorious diversion at which nothing changed in the end.
Nick, I was on MSNBC this morning with a co-panelist, Max Das Boot, and he was lamenting that his former party that he no longer feels home in, the Republican Party. The party left him in part because they no longer venerate the FBI. And he just can't even anymore. You had a post about this kind of concept, the role switching among the two parties about their treatments of the FBI. Why should we not weep for James Comey's poetry about the Statue of Liberty, Nick Lesby?
You mean who was for a while was tweeting under the name Reinhold Niebuhr, the great anti-Nazi theologian and preacher of peace. And
I'd
whatnot.
Have more respect for
the favorite Niebuhr. Philosopher of both Andrew Sullivan and David Brooks
and Jimmy Carter.
Yeah. So
is it all actually Reinhold Niebuhr's fault? Is all of the American political debate actually laid at his doorstep?
When we get that time machine, he's the one we have to go back to wipe out.
Yeah, let's leave Hitler alive. Just go right for Reinhold Niebuhr.
You know, here, let's look, you know, I realize that I've got, I've been riding this hobby horse, pretty frantically over the past couple of years. But if you look back, you know, going back to, and you can start it in all sorts of different ways. An easy place to start this is really like the 1960 election where John F. Kennedy narrowly beat Richard Nixon. There was clearly voter irregularity in a couple of states that might have tipped a very close election to Kennedy. Kennedy lied about U.S. involvement in Vietnam. That became a thing, right? And LBJ had what was called the credibility gap at the time. The Pentagon was lying to people. The government was so flatly and plainly, clearly lying after the Kennedy assassination, the way that the Warren Commission acted, the way there was this, you know, just a ton of secrecy that the government imposed. The government lied about stuff. Then there was the Pentagon Papers. Then there was Watergate. Then there was, you know, things like the Church Commission, which revealed and exposed massive illegal behavior by the National Security Agency, by the FBI, by the CIA, where the CIA was pulling jobs in America, which it is not allowed to do. The FBI was infiltrating peace organizations that had nothing to do with anything but because J. Edgar Hoover was obsessed with them. All of this stuff comes out. government has done everything possible at the highest level and oftentimes at the lowest level to lose the respect and the confidence of American people. And the FBI is really one of the leading institutions that has done that. You know, the way they acted in places like Ruby Ridge and Waco, the way that the FBI continues to kind of fool around with stuff. I mean, you know, we saw this in under Obama, where it was like, you know, he lied about surveillance programs. And then when Edward Snowden pantsed him, he was like, oh, you know, I think it'd be a really good idea if we had a national conversation about the surveillance state. I really welcome this opportunity. And he was just lying. And this is why I don't weep for the FBI's credibility, not because we do need an FBI or some kind of Federal Bureau of Investigation, and we need one that we can believe in. We don't have that. And everybody's response when they get caught, you know, because of forced transparency, is always to be like, no, you should just trust us blindly. You should, you know, because we were better in the past. But we weren't. And we need, you know, this is where I think people like Rand Paul and Ron Wyden, despite what Catherine is right about, you know, like they're both going to think the same way that they were before all of this happened, partly because of partisanship. But they formed the nucleus of a group of legislators who would actually kind of restart our intelligence operations in a way that we can build confidence,
Peter,
and trust. That's what
Peter,
we need.
Yeah, so I think what's interesting about a lot of this is that this is an instance of both sides, you know, sort of every side in this argument is attempting to say, well, you should trust us, but not the other guy, right? So this is Donald Trump saying, you know, well, you, of course you should trust me. I'm the president. I've been, you know, you elected me. I'm the one telling the truth. And it's the FBI who's, you know, coming after me. And the FBI and its defenders, you know, Democrats are all saying, well, of course, it's, you know, it's the institutional integrity of the FBI here. And right. And like,
This is basically just a giant game of mafia.
Yeah, right. I mean,
what does that mean?
None of them have the kind of integrity that they are claiming to have, and it's really it's pretty thin and weak on all sides.
So mafia is like a parlor game in which you some of you are the townsfolk, and some of you are the mafia, and you have to try and figure out who is who. It's a bluffing game, right? So everybody says, no, I'm an innocent townsfolk. And then you have to kind of talk amongst yourself to figure it out. And, you know, you generally profit by accusing everyone of everything all the time, except for if you do that too much and then people start to suspect you.
True fact about mafia, and this is totally a tangent. In New York City, or at least Brooklyn, or at least our Brooklyn elementary school ground, mafia is a frequently played game among the kids. My 9-year-old does this, where a group of girls or whatever gets together and they decide who's going to be the hitman that's going to be killed, and then who's going to try to talk them out of it. Like it's got all these sort of formal rules. Nick, they didn't have these kind of games in California. What can I infer from that?
Well, you know, they did when I grew up in New Jersey.
Did they really?
What a surprise.
And realized that, you know, yeah, you know, that that people in power oftentimes lie. But
in New Jersey,
I think,
it wasn't
you know,
a game.
By the way, this is also the basis of a new game from the makers of Cards Against Humanity called Secret Hitler, in which some of you are fascists and some of you are liberals.
But the best way to be an effective Hitler and like to have the fascist twin is to play as liberal as you can right up until the moment where you consolidate your power.
Please note, listeners who just joined us, that was Peter describing a board game and not our philosophy for how we run reason. Thank you. The end.
Think from a libertarian perspective, the current moment and the trend line of, you know, less and less trust in all sources of power, because if you look at people feel less comfortable with big business. They feel less comfortable with churches. I mean, it's not simply government institutions. Libertarian rhetoric has always posited that power is something that is dangerous and always needs to be reined in, et cetera. But to the extent that we say that government is fundamentally or constitutionally incompetent and inefficient and must be destroyed, et cetera, we are actually helping to corrode society, not necessarily wrongly, but if we don't replace it with legitimate functions or ways in which these institutions can be reconstituted, where they are effective, they're limited, and they're transparent, we're part of the problem. And, you know, one of the things that is deeply worrying to me, and I've written a lot about this, is that as trust in government goes down, traditionally or consistently around the globe, people in low trust societies actually call for the government. They support the government to regulate more and more parts of the economy in their lives, even though they know the government is corrupt. We need to come up with a different framework and a different rhetoric, because we're already seeing from Gallup and other places, more and more people are saying that the government should be doing more things to help people. You know, and we need to arrest that. And I think, again, we're at the end of the road for a lot of stuff that you and I especially grew up with, Matt. I think Gen Xers and late baby boomers, we need a new paradigm, and it needs to be, you know, with people like Rand Paul and Ron Wyden, people like Justin Amash and Thomas Massie. I think there are Democrats as well. Jared Polis is probably one of them when it comes to stuff like intelligence and the way that, computer or big data can take over in ways that we're not clear about. We need transparency in government. We don't need cover your ass stuff, which is all we're
getting. Catherine, how can it be that literally the same 3-week span, we're having this incredibly frenzied conversation about Sebastian Gorka described as being 100 times worse than the underlying problems that caused the colonists to revolt against King George. Right now, Fox is on fire talking about.
Gorka is such a master of understatement, and I'm pretty sure English isn't even a first language.
Vigorous agreement. But
and neither is Matt.
Never was. But it's like 3 weeks ago they voted on this, and the same people who voted who were saying these incredibly hyperbolic things, just en masse voted in favor of keeping the ability to snoop. Without even a warrant, without even like fudging the details on a warrant, like nope, no warrant. We're just collecting it on everybody. Explain how that happens. How there wasn't a parallel conversation happening at that moment besides the Rand Paul, Ron Wyden ghetto.
I mean, this is part and parcel with what Peter was describing earlier, right? It's if your theory of governance is as long as we are in charge, it will be okay. But if they are in charge, it will be bad. And not, well, what powers are the people who are in charge, you know, what powers should they be accorded? Then this is what you get. You get a let's authorize maximum authority for the people in charge, and then let's do absolutely everything within our power every single day of every single year to get that power and hold it, then you get what we have right now, right? Nobody's saying, okay, the solution is let's think again about the scope of our surveillance state or the scope of executive authority or the scope of what industries government should essentially dominate. Instead, it's just like, nope, as long as the right people in charge, it will be fine. And this is, you know, in many ways, this is the inside of public choice, that you don't have to be a bad, evil conspirator to still fuck everything up for everyone all the time.
This, I mean, it's pretty ironic. If you go back just a year and a half ago to the campaign, the perception, probably correctly, was that the CIA was the pro-Hillary organization and the FBI was the conservative pro-Trump organization. And you had pretty clearly folks inside both of those intelligence agencies, not maybe leaking like classified super secret documents, but leaking, talking to friendly to that, to whatever side you're talking about, press anonymously, right? And like, And now it is totally reversed, where Trump and the Republicans are like, no, the FBI has been out to get me for years.
James Comey leaked documents, you know, after he was fired as FBI chief.
That's right. He admitted it was kind of interesting in his testimony to Congress, described, I forget the name of the person, but told Congress who it was that he leaked to and said, and I basically, I would like you to get these out in the press. And then, of course, that generated a big New York Times story.
Go ahead.
This, you know, one of the problems is, like, I mean, in a way, we are living, like, I think Trump is an effect, not a cause of current issues, but he's also perpetuating it. And if you go, I mean, we're living in Trump's mind now, and it is a terrifying place to be, because everything is about, you know, just positional change and like, do I have the advantage here for the next day or for the next hour for, you know, this cycle of tweets? And you're paranoid, you're delusional, everything revolves around you completely. It's not a good place to be. We need to really pull out of this. And, you know, the fact that, you know, at the same time that we have this stuff going on, we have like the, you know, the immigration fight over DACA is, you know, that's coming due in a month or so. And there's no reason to believe that either the Republicans and Democrats can really come together on that. They can't pass a budget. They can't even produce budgets. It's got to stop. I mean, it really does. And it's not that, you know, we'll descend into total madness, but like, if we want to be half the country,
we could be. Some of us really do need.
Yeah, well,
you've gotten too close to the story.
I understand,
Suderman. But there is one way, and this is a segue alert. There is one way in which, power has been devolving a little bit, or at least people who are interested in the devolution of powers have been making and taking actions in the Trump presidency in ways that I think are pretty interesting. And that's in the regulatory state. We talked about this briefly in our post State of the Union, Peter Suderman drunk monologue hour. But he mentioned in the State of the Union, by the way, State of the Union, 6 days ago. How many thousands of weeks does it feel like when Donald Trump gave the State of the Union address? Anyways, he mentioned in the State of the Union.
It's like older than the Grammys, you know, which also feel like a couple of thousand years ago, to be quite honest.
He mentioned the phrase right to try. Peter Suderman, can you tell us a little bit about that, putting on your healthcare guy hat, and what the prospects for the excitements thereof, limitations thereof here about this is the second State of the Union address in a row where the president has emphasized ways to kind of radically reform the Food and Drug Administration in ways that that help human lives. Can you tell us about it?
So first of all, the hat doesn't say healthcare guy. It says health policy wonk. Second of all, I wasn't drunk. And third of all, I would actually think
You just pulled a Rick Perry. No, you couldn't remember
could
the third thing.
The third thing is the answer to the question.
Is that they should read Ron Bailey's post on exactly this topic from last week. And Ron Bailey at Reason.com argued that, in fact, right to try, as is being proposed, is a good idea, but not all that radical and not nearly a big enough step. Because basically what right to try does is it says that if you get to the point where the safety testing is all done and you're only testing for efficacy. And so what that
we're
means
testing
is
drugs here.
Right?
I've got
only
a new drug. It's going to cure my face.
You get through this fairly arduous, fairly expensive federal Food and Drug Administration pharmaceutical drug clinical trials process, which is, sort of a long time target of people who are frustrated with government regulations. And there's a holdup for every single drug that people want to bring to the market. So right now, you have to go through what's called an efficacy test. And what Right to Try would do is basically say, well, we don't have to test for efficacy. We have to test for safety. And safety is like the baseline that if you're going to have government regulation, that's where it should be focused. And so all Right to Try does is say, let's get it to the point where we believe we have good reason to believe through major clinical trials that it will still be expensive, that it's safe. There's been some criticism of Right to Try because a bunch of states, I believe it's 38, have passed Right to Try laws. The problem with states passing Right to Try laws is states don't regulate drugs. They're regulated at the federal level by the FDA. And so the state-based laws have been not entirely but largely symbolic at this point. And so what Trump was promoting was a federal right to try law. One has already passed in the Senate. It may end up getting passed in the House. But I really think that, again, people should go back and read Ron Bailey's post, because what Ron Bailey says, and I think pretty convincingly, is that this is not nearly enough and that what we really need is to completely reorganize and rethink the way we do clinical trials at the FDA. And we need to be thinking about, like, what is the minimum type regulation that we can do, the minimum sorts of required testing that we can do before that we can get drugs out to people who need them and who want them. And
I think you're right. And I think, you know, just to tie it into my monomaniacal theory of, you know, at the end of the road, when you look at, and I know most of this from stuff I've read by Ron Bailey over the years, but, you know, the current clinical trial process started after the thalidomide scare in the late 50s and early 60s. And it is an institution, you know, and we can debate whether or not it was good on balance or it actually killed more people than it saved, but its time is up. And we need a different system and a different framework of regulation and of what is the government providing us. It does not have to provide us safe and effective drugs. It has to, you know, because there are better ways to do that. You know, and we need a lighter regulatory touch. And to tie into what Matt was talking about, this is a place where Trump, you know, whether he really means it or it's just whatever, he's actually doing some good work here.
So the most interesting thing about Trump is that at the regulatory level, he's often quite, he's sort of batting and in narrow ways, he's batting sort of a above average. And I think the reason for that is that Trump is exerting less direct control, less direct sort of direction over the agencies. And so you can look at, and so where he has a good person in place, somebody who has a clear theory, someone like Scott Gottlieb, who is running the FDA now, who was an AEI policy scholar, like basically focused on FDA issues, who worked at the FDA previously. And so both knows kind of the outside, knows the institution from the outside as a critic, but also has worked inside it and knows how to work its levers. You see really like quite good results. On the other hand, at someplace like HUD, where you have somebody like Ben Carson, you see him working with his family members and people whose like qualifications is that they planned one of the Trump son's weddings and like not really having any plans or knowing what to do and not being any given any real clear direction from the White House. And this is a big change, I think, from the way that the Obama White House worked, where the agencies, even when they were kind of theoretically independent, like the FCC, were really pretty strongly run out of the White House, at least given fairly clear directions and instructions about what their major goals should be and what they should be pursuing. And so, you know, it's a little bit hit and miss, right? You have some upsides and some downsides, but it allows somebody like Scott Gottlieb to really kind of to make
one way, Peter, and not to disagree, but to amplify what you said, one way that Trump has exerted a lot of influence, even on the HUDs of the world, is his opening salvo executive orders, particularly the gotta kill two regulations for every new one, order, and then also probably more influentially, the order to have a net zero in terms of the effects, economic effects of regulations that are proposed in a given year. So, yeah, you can have a nice, juicy $100 million regulation over here. You bet you got to cut a couple of 50s in order.
But again, that's not an instruction about what
Correct.
To do, right?
Right?
About like which goals
no,
to
but
pursue
it's, but
with
it's
the
a,
FDA or whether to,
as I said,
you know, repeal
as I said,
net neutrality.
That was an
right?
amplification, so, Peter.
I think he also said that about immigrants, that you have to deport two for every one that you bring in.
Apparently, that is where we're ending up, actually.
Yeah, Catherine, I mean, literally.
I was interviewing a nameless regulatory state person here, and you'll understand why I'm not going to mention the name here. This is going to fill your heart with dread, what I'm going to tell you here, because you can just imagine how many things I'm going to write that are keyed from here. But someone who is in the position to absolutely kind of know modern regulatory history made some joking wisecrack about like, wow, we wouldn't want to do it like Jimmy Carter. And I was like, oh, yeah? You mean you don't know about Jimmy Carter's history of deregulation? And the person's eyes widened and like, oh, no, not really. Nick, the work that you and I have tried to do over the years, still so much
work
to be
done.
But I put this to you, Catherine, in a light of a bit of news that it has just kind of trickled through without much attention being paid. I forget which bureaucracy it was, but over the last 4 or 5 days, there's been a kind of a quiet announcement that, oh, probably this year's deficit or the amount of debt that we're going to issue in this year is going to go up to like $928 billion. We're going to get close to the $1 trillion deficit in this year. And this is concurrent with as we were speaking, or at least as the markets opened today. They were tanking like 300 points in the first minute, and this is after a big sell-off on Friday. And what a lot of people are saying is it's tied to that bit of news. When the debt load is so huge and it's much bigger than you expected, and now the cost of borrowing is going up, particularly on U.S. Treasuries, like people are starting to freak out, like, oh, no, debt is bad now for economics. And so the question is, could that be, will that be a motivator in the way that such things were in the 70s with your Jimmy Carters and your Jerry Browns and other people, when like inflation and crap economics kind of pushed everybody into a mode of desperation? Could we be in desperate times, not just even for regulation, but for other type of policies? Just we got to save money from somewhere.
I think so. And I think this is, you know, Trump has enjoyed bragging about the stock market so far. He's taken a lot of credit for stock market performance to date. And there has been a sort of superstition hanging around Washington that, oh, maybe actually increased debt and deficit doesn't slow economic growth after all. Maybe that was a thing that we believed in the 20th century that's not true anymore. But everyone has this in the back of their minds, in the same way that we keep in the back of our minds that maybe the Russians are the real enemy. And a couple pieces of evidence in that column can swing people back. I think it would be really valuable if people do swing back. But in the current administration and partisan balance in Washington, it's very hard for me to imagine how that sort of comprehensive fiscal conservatism, or that comprehensive understanding of how all of these pieces work together, can be revived. And I would like it to be revived. But this is actually, I think, more broadly, like, this is our post-ideological presidency. And, you know, what you guys were saying about how the places where there's a specific agency where an ideologue is in charge, those are the ones that are doing okay, right? And under Obama, the ideologue was the president. And so his ideology trickled down through the whole thing. Trump is not an ideologue. He has no guiding ideology. And I don't know how he will interpret the market signal if the market does start to tank. It's not clear to me. He'll be like, oh, maybe it's because we have a fucking $1 trillion that we now
buy. But in a post-ideological presidency in the United States, like, what that looks like is the Trump presidency, which is a complete disinterest in any kind of entitlement reform combined with tax cuts, which is the recipe for much higher debt.
Absolutely.
And deficits.
Can I just say it's a lack of interest in entitlement reform? Disinterest means something different.
Really?
Total lack of interest.
Yep. Disinterest means disinterested means you're impartial.
Oh, right, right, right.
That's right. That you're not involved, like you're not looking for one.
So, Nick, damn you. So in a year...
You know, Matt, we were digging with a teaspoon when we should have been using a goddamn steam shovel.
Is that your semi-parabola? What was was the word? You semi-parlanda.
Semi-parlanda. Look it
tell,
up if you
tell our listeners what that is.
No, you know what? There's a world of network computer.
They're all driving right now. They're listening. They're driving in their cars.
Yeah, no, text Alexa, and drive. She text will, and drive. We won't get to driverless cars until, you know, people insist on it.
I feel
it,
like semi-parlando has got to be some sort of obscure Russian cake frosting technique.
No, it was, weren't you guys in high school plays and stuff like that, in musicals? Semi-parlando is sometimes a direction where you speak the words of a song rather than sing.
How dare you impugn Peter Suderman's record, first of all.
I played Captain Hook.
What?
And I switched hands.
That role is
I switched the hook. Wait, hand every act.
That role is only
parlando. I hope it was a mashup with The Sound of Music. So you were Captain Hook, but you were marrying Maria, the ex-nun.
That's how you solve the problem like Maria, by the way. You just got to marry that thing right up.
Yeah, that's
they
right.
They sang
yeah.
that.
You know, and Ralph.
Crocodile eats her.
Ralph is one of the lost boys.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, Nick.
Yeah, what were you going to ask?
In an era, in a season in which that message of, hey, look, debt is bad for growth after a certain level, went from being central to conservative critiques of Obama to central to supporting tax cuts. Amazing thing to watch. At some point, we've been saying this for a long time, the cost of borrowing goes up and you got to borrow a lot. That's a problem, a huge, huge problem. Politically, what is the way back in an era where, as a really perceptive cover story in Reason Magazine about a year and a half ago called Debt Denialist pointed out, there is no major party now. Even Max Boot said it to me again on set today. It's like, I wish there was a party that was really wanted to be fiscally conservative. And there just isn't anymore. And
let's, one thing, we got to start saying fiscally responsible, because conservatives have never been.
Yeah. And actually, I think that was the term you even used there. But like, how politically do we go back? Yeah. Do we just need to Macron this one? And like, all right, third party didn't exist yesterday. It's going to get 70% of the vote because the old ones just all got to die now.
I'm still kind of coming down from talking to one of my favorite political scientists last week when I was doing some work in San Francisco, Morris Fiorina, who talks about how, the parties have sorted so that, the Republicans are the conservative party, the Democrats are the liberal party. They don't overlap. They have different agendas. And unfortunately, one place where they have the same agenda, which is to spend as much money as you can in order to either buy or maintain your voter share, it is a real problem. And I think, all I can say is hopefully as journalists, who are trying to do the work of bringing certain things to light, having large, huge amounts of growing national debt over time is not good for the economy. It's not good for job creation. It's not good in the long term. And pretty much every economist agrees with that. And we need to start clawing back. I think it's going to start with like stopping increases in entitlements. But we need a radical, I was reading a book, a fantastic book called The Most Dangerous Man in America, or The Most Dangerous Man in the World, about Timothy Leary when he was on the run from the U.S. government in Afghanistan and Algeria and Switzerland and whatnot. But like, we need a consciousness raising. And I don't know exactly how to do it other than, talking a lot about it as the very first step, because this kind of debt problem, and it's not that it's going to happen overnight and we're going to, be wearing pickle barrels and selling apples on the street corners or something like that.
Speak for yourself.
But it is slowly. Yeah, that's true.
Job in Matt's neighborhood.
Yeah, I did read the latest issue of Teen Vogue, edited by Hillary Clinton. I know that's a fashion now. But it's, we need to start talking about the function of politics as something different than what it seems to be now, which is a game of mafia. It is a game of partisanship, and it's about taking as much as you can, and holding on to it as the Titanic is kind of, going up in the air and everything's sliding off into the ocean.
I like the idea of a consciousness raising here, and like the fiscal equivalent of that scene in Doctor Strange where he shows up at like the Tibetan like spiritual superhero monastery, and like his forehead gets touched, and then suddenly it's like, whoa, yeah. Cosmic, yeah, whoa, like somewhere out of his body, and
are
in
you
on steroids. And
so in this metaphor,
so
are you the Tilda Swinton
like if,
character?
If bra burning helped raise the consciousness of feminism, what's the fiscal equivalent? What's the monetary policy equivalent?
I don't know who the Tilda Swinton character is here. I'm hoping it's someone on this podcast. I'll volunteer to be Tilda Swinton if no one else wants to be. But like, all of America is Stephen Strange.
Want to be Tilda Swinton? Just
in
to be
the
clear.
In like the fiscal cosmos.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. And I actually think Nick, I don't know that we have an obvious. That there is no bra of fiscal responsibility, but
Bernanke's beard.
But it's probably lines. It's probably scarcity, right? It's probably the moment when sort of people are queuing up for something. It's like, it's waiting for gas in the 70s. Like, it needs to be something super, super tangible and obvious. And I don't know exactly which one of those it will play out as. But right now we're living in a world where cutting the rate of growth of spending immediately causes every opponent to descend into a howling mass of people who are like, we have to fire and then murder all the school teachers because of you. I'm really struggling to see how we get to a place where we talk about this in a sane way.
So there's an alternative, and I was recently sort of introduced to an idea that I'm still sort of considering. I'm not endorsing this.
Were you introduced to this idea by Tilda Swinton in Doctor Strange?
My forehead was touched.
Okay.
And then everything became if you think of a color negative except psychotropic.
It's like a laser light show. Laser Genesis.
Peter's wearing an actual cape right now, just so you all know.
What happens at 8 p.m. at Epcot Center over the lake every single night. No, the basic idea was if you want to reform Medicare in particular, which is the biggest of the entitlements and sort of the biggest long-term contributor to the debt, the goal should be not to have a sort of a radical change and cutback, but at least in the short term, to find a way to provide a better and more enticing service to seniors that is also semi-privatized, market-driven, and costs less. And so people will choose it simply because it's better. And basically the goal here is to expand Medicare Advantage and also to rein in costs in Medicare Advantage. I'm not endorsing this, but I can see it as a plausible path to a somewhat more stable system. Perhaps not one that is like the ideal almost certainly one that is not the ideal libertarian system. But if you can create something that is like, here is more choice and better service, that's a way to get people out of the current system.
So the solution there, though, you're describing is coming up with healthcare for old people that is like the equivalent of email to the U.S. Postal Service, right? Like somebody has to sweep in with like a dramatic, huge change in the whole system. Probably it comes from the private sector. The trouble is the Postal Service still exists and it's still losing money. The world in which there is a radical solution that comes from the private sector does not necessarily strike me as a world in which it solves the underlying fiscal problem.
What I'm saying is Jeff Bezos, who announced that he was starting a healthcare company last week along with Berkshire Hathaway and JP Morgan Chase, Jeff Bezos needs to come in and disrupt Medicare.
And he also already put himself in a Super Bowl commercial. So can we
that
agree that
terrible,
that was step one?
By the way,
that may have actually been like step.
Oh, I thought that
really?
I thought that
we don't
was
know
one
what.
Okay, so let's go straight to Super Bowl ads since the segue wrote itself.
By the way, I do want to point out that for students of the Bible, the Philadelphia Eagles actually winning a big game is like, you know, it's on.
We've uncracked the sixth seal.
The rapture is upon us. For sure.
You're a lover and a former resident of the city of brotherly love, Nick Gillespie. It's fond in.
They have tremendous sandwiches. It's a tremendous sandwich culture in Philadelphia, Matt.
So what did you enjoy about the Super Bowl yesterday besides the Patriots losing and people eating, literally eating horse shit on the streets of Philadelphia afterwards?
I thought it was a really good game. And, I say this like all, right-thinking Americans. Of course, I simultaneously hate and admire the hell out of Bill Belichick and Tom Brady. And, you know, they're pretty good losers. They're great winners, but they're good losers. I thought it was a great game, and it was a testament to the fighting
spirit.
They
lose in really good games and in ways that were creditable. Suderman, did you have any favorite commercials, presuming that you watched the sports ball on television?
I did watch it, and I regretted watching it because it's the only professional sports game that I will watch all the way through each year. And really, kind of only for the commercials, even more than that, like only for the excuse to make chicken wings, which I love in a sort of perhaps over the top way. I actually did not have any particular commercial that I really loved this year. The one thing that I thought was fascinating and notable was Netflix announcing the third Cloverfield film, which and announcing, and the first, this was the first advertisement we've seen for this movie. We've known it's coming, but they announced it and then said, and it'll be online on Netflix, available to watch right after the game. And so this is a really big deal, especially for a film that 2 or 3 weeks ago we were expecting to be released theatrically. Now, it's been bumped a couple of times and delayed, and the early reviews make it look like it's kind of a stinker. So what it looks like here is basically that the studio said, hey, Netflix, you give us moderate hit money, and that will cover our risk for, like, you know, we'll at least make sure we make enough off of this. On the other hand, like, it's still a kind of big business model innovation for Netflix to be buying franchise films that have already existed in theaters and that were previously scheduled on multiple occasions for release in theaters, announcing them with 2 hours of notice, basically, that they are being released. And so this was the big surprise from this Cloverfield, a franchise that has always been built around kind of not just narrative, but production and advertising based surprises.
Yeah, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I feel like you really, you just drained all possible joy, not out of only out
there
of
was never any joy in the Super Bowl me, Peter.
Or the coming week. I have joy for you. You want to have some Super Bowl advertisement joy?
Yes.
That the great ad where the robots mock the human. Come on, you guys. This is like super great reason ad in which the sort of it basically looks like the Westworld backstage is full of artificially intelligent robots and a dude who has, I guess, I forget which direction it is. He had AT&T. The robots are like, you idiot, you should definitely have Sprint. And then at the end of the commercial, when the guy asks him why he changed to Sprint, he says, oh, my coworkers were making fun of me. And like right there, that's the future that libertarians want. The other ad that was really good was the E-Trade ad, which was like a Super Bowl ad about how America's not saving enough and old people are going to have to work forever. And it sort of made light of it. But, you know,
it's true. Save your money, kids.
Save your money.
I also was mildly, and I'm not sure if it was a national ad or it might have just I was watching in New York, but Pizza Hut threatened customers that they were going to get the pizza to you faster. And that's, you know, like, I don't know if the Consumer Protection Financial Board is still around, but I would like to, you know, raise some kind of suit against that. Yeah.
Pizza
Hut should need to go through phase 3 and 4 clinical trial. Like, we need to invent some extra phases.
Well, as you know, one of my big bugaboos
is with
the
a new place to hide
menu
cheese
labeling.
Yet?
Rule. No, they've hidden, they stuffed the cheese with cheese and then it was over.
What's going to happen now that Domino's is like commoditizing pizza risk? Like when those credit default swaps on Domino's pizza is getting ruined before, you know, when people do all the call-ins to get their second pizza back, we're screwed.
If anything, we're in a burrito bubble, not in a pizza bubble.
In a just world, Hungry Howie's, a Florida-based pizza chain that has really great garlic crust and also just like dirt cheap pizzas, will take over America.
Hungry Howie's is famous. They have like seven or eight different crusts, I believe.
Oh,
isn't that
God.
Their whole shtick?
Speaking of which, I saw Howie Kurtz in the MSNBC Green Room. He works at Fox, but he was at the Green Room today. So speaking of Hungry Howie, I feel like I just want to name drop median.
Should we put other Howies? Any other Howies?
Mid career thing.
Howie Mandel. I saw Howie Mandel at Penn Station. I gave him a quarter.
He's still doing the thing,
blowing the surgical glove off his face.
Okay. I saw Howard the Duck on Demand.
How does it hold up?
I mean,
what would that question even mean?
What would holding up be like for Howard?
Is it one of those movies that was widely panned but is now recognized as, you know, a minor classic or
like the Last Action Hero?
It is. So Last Action Hero is a legit great movie. Don't get me started. It did for action movies what Scream did for horror years beforehand, and arguably in it was even better. No, but like the thing about Howard the Duck is it's
oh my God,
so...
I can't believe that was a real segue that you just said. You fully was like, no, but look, the thing about Howard the Duck, and then you're going to say a real sentence right now.
Yeah, it's
what's wrong with you?
So deliriously, like, full bore weird that you have to respect it.
Matt, save us.
He is the AI, Catherine. That's the problem with AI. What's his face is right. They're all going to kill us. I will close this all out.
Who is what? What's their face?
Stephen Hawking and or Elon Musk. I was going to say
Elon Musk, but I got
the
Musk shy because
Elon Musk.
He comes
you
up
talk
too
about
often.
A guy who's trying to keep people from you know, like looking away from his absolute failure to deliver his latest big car, right?
I'm ill qualified to judge, but unlike my judging qualities, and we'll end on this discordant note. Watching the Super Bowl last night with a room full of sub 10-year-old girls, about six of them, when the Pizza Hut, aforementioned Pizza Hut ad came on, and this, as you could tell, like these kids are New York kids, all of them in unison looking at the Pizza Hut said, just like shuddered in revulsion. So I'm afraid that my daughters have gone completely native because, man, if I saw a Pizza Hut ad on television in Long Beach, California growing up, I would just order seven of them just as a defense mechanism.
Like a Pavlovian response.
It was a fancy sit-down restaurant, and they actually – my Pizza Hut would give kids free – personal pizzas for completing reading lists. So of course I ate.
What kind of hellscape do you emanate from?
Of Pizza Hut pizza as a kid.
Do you remember the Pizza Hut ads where they would fly over like the macaroni dishes to like Tuscany and serve Pizza Hut, you know, like rotini with cheese in a high class, you know, a genuine restaurant or something. And people would be like, this is the most delicious pasta I ever ate. And then they would reveal it to be Pizza Hut.
I think
I can't wait for the artisanal food truck version of whatever it is that you just described.
No, it was as good as when Folgers crystals would be served at like Maxime's in New Orleans and stuff.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Like, this is the most delicious coffee I've ever had.
Really? Because you're soaking in it.
And well, that was the weirdest ad, that Hyundai ad where they took people off the street and were like, you know, you went through this metal detector, you have cancer, so we're going to give you a Hyundai. Did you guys see this ad? I don't think that was my own private Idaho I was living in. There was a Hyundai ad where they pulled people off the street and like gave them Hyundais, and it was, you know, and Hyundai is going to cure cancer by giving people free cars.
Nick, I think you might be gaslighting us.
This is what happens in
late capitalism. Let me explain to you what gaslighting is.
Okay. Goodbye, everyone. We will see you next week. Keep listening to Reason Podcast throughout the week with a bunch of different interviews. I hope we're going to cut Peter Suderman's mic once and for all. But on behalf of all of these weirdos, see you later.
Rate and review. Subscribe.
And do that, too. Goodbye.